One of the most striking moments in all of the Old Testament occurs in Isaiah 6. Isaiah 6, sometimes described as Isaiah's call to be a prophet, maybe not exactly what's going on there. The idea is, the way the book's been put together, all of a sudden you have Isaiah 6 chapters in receiving his call. Do I need to move to another microphone? No. What's that? Okay. All right. Just want to make sure. So you got 6 chapters in. Is this a call or is it a reaffirmation that's going on here? Is there something else going on that now all of a sudden in Isaiah 6, we get this incredible moment where Isaiah is in God's presence? Maybe it's a reaffirmation. Maybe that's what's going on here, because maybe we get a clue in the first line here in Isaiah 6 that in the year that King Uzziah died, who cares? Well, maybe that's more than just a time stamp on the photo. Maybe it's a clue as to how to hear this. Because, see, Uzziah had been king for over 50 years. Over 50 years. If things had gone a little bit differently between 1775 and 1781, things had gone a little bit differently, we might still be talking about Her Majesty the Queen. Let's just see a show of hands. How many people here born after February the 6th, 1952? You were born after. If that's the case, you would have known no other monarch other than Queen Elizabeth II. She would be the only person you had ever known to have been the queen. It was the same in Uzziah's time. People who were less than 52 years old would have never known another monarch. There would have been no one else that they would have known. And it was a time of relative peace and a time of great prosperity for the southern kingdom. It was a good time. When you're at the top of the heap, you always get credit for that. And so when King Uzziah died, that would have been a time of some uncertainty. I mean, everything's going well. Peace, prosperity. And maybe not everything's going well. See, for about the last 10 years of his reign, he had been kind of out of circulation because he had this skin disease, and so he wasn't allowed to be in circulation. But he was still kind of head of state behind the scenes, even as his son and heir Jotham was sort of the head of government, kind of running things on a day-to-day basis. But Uzziah was still the one on the top of the heap, the top of the pyramid. And then when he dies, what's going to happen? Well, wait, everything was peace and prosperity. What's going to happen? Now, not everything had been great, at least not in terms of at least the last part of his reign. It was not necessarily a time of great virtue there at the top of the heap. In fact, the reason that he had the skin disease that he had was because he had been kind of obnoxious and arrogant and, presumptuous before God, and God had allowed him to have the disease. But, it's a time of peace and prosperity. And so long as the economy's good, so long as my portfolio's doing well, so long as our enemies have at least enough fear of us to stay away, who cares? Who cares about the virtue of the national leader? But then Uzziah dies. When Uzziah dies, is this going to continue? In the ancient world, it was not unusual when a king died, whether the king had ruled long, but particularly if the king had ruled for a long time, if the king had ruled long or short, the king dies. It's a time of uncertainty. It's a time of wondering what's going to happen. And it was not unusual for some of the surrounding nations to say, this is a time to test, to see just how strong they really are. So the king dies, everyone's going, are we still going to have peace? We're still going to have prosperity. Some of us are old enough, I'm not, some of us are old enough in this room to remember 1961 when John F. Kennedy becomes president of the United States, and it's in the height of the Cold War. And early in his administration, 1961, he goes to Vienna to meet with Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union. Khrushchev, an old, wily, cold warrior, basically just handles Kennedy. And there are a lot of historians who think you can draw a direct line from him thinking Kennedy was soft and inexperienced and didn't know which end was up, directly to 1962 and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Because he thought, Eisenhower, seasoned guy. Couldn't get one over on him. Kennedy, kind of soft. New guy. Probably can. In the ancient world, that happened a lot when a ruler died. So in that little phrase, in the year that King Uzziah died, there is captured a lot of anxiety. There's captured a lot of uncertainty. The reality is that with his death, there would have been great uncertainty. Will the good times continue? And it's in that context that Isaiah has this experience. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lofty, and the hem of his robe filled the temple. Seraphs were in attendance above him. Each had six wings. With two they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." The pivots on the thresholds shook at the voices of those who called, and the house filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me. I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among people of unclean lips. Yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphs flew to me, holding a live coal that had been taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. The seraph touched my mouth with it and said, "Now that this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed and your sin is blotted out." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I, send me." And he said, "Go. And say to this people, keep listening, but do not comprehend. Keep looking, but do not understand. Make the mind of this people dull and stop their ears and shut their eyes so that they may not look with their eyes and listen with their ears and comprehend with their minds and turn and be healed." Then I said, "How long, O Lord?" And he said, "Until cities lie waste without inhabitant, and houses without people, and the land is utterly desolate, until the Lord sends everyone far away, and vast is the emptiness in the midst of the land. Even if a tenth part remain in it, it will be burned again, like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains standing when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump." Now, I know most of that last bit is kind of a downer, and I wanted to read it anyway, just because I'm that kind of guy. No. It's a downer because it looks forward to the time that even despite the fact that you've got people like Isaiah who are willing to speak for God, that the people aren't going to listen. And that in about a century and a half, indeed, the people will be ripped from the land, taken into exile in Babylon. There is just a little smidgen of hope there at the end. Nothing left but a burned stump. But the holy seed is its stump. But what I really want to focus on at first is that first part that he talks about, that first encounter, the temple filled with the presence of God as Isaiah goes in there. I mean, can we even imagine that scene? How would any of us react if we found ourselves in some unmistakable way in the presence of God? In some way that just we couldn't, maybe like Isaiah, we have trouble describing it fully, but we're there in the presence of God. And how in the world would we react to that? Here, Isaiah is awestruck, deeply humbled, deeply convicted of his sinfulness. But here's something else for us to draw out of this deep well. If God is on the throne of the universe, now remember, King Uzziah, who'd been on the throne for 50 plus years, has just died. But here's God on the throne. And if God is on the throne of the universe, then It does not matter who's on any earthly throne. There should be no doubt of our ultimate allegiance. It's as if God is saying very strongly to Isaiah here, look, what does it matter who's on the throne there on earth? You go represent me. There should be no doubt. No doubt. If God is on the throne, that's our ultimate allegiance. I'm not 100% sure we fully believe that. I mean, we pay that lip service. I'm not sure that we ever really did believe that. But I think if we were face to face with God, we'd believe that. We'd get it. Isaiah certainly got it. And I think if we were ever face to face to God, the message might be the same. What does it matter who's on the throne? What does it matter who's in the Oval Office? What does it matter who's in 10 Downing Street? What does it matter who's in the Kremlin? What does it matter if I'm on the throne? What does it matter? Since I'm on the throne, you go represent me. Remember that last bit in Isaiah's encounter with God. It's like God saying, look, it's not going to be easy. It will not be easy to represent me because you'll encounter a lot of people whose ears are stopped and whose eyes are closed. They don't have your knowledge. They've not seen what you've seen, but you know what you know, and you have seen what you have seen, and you need to represent. Seems to me that God uses people who recognize that he is on the throne, who recognize that he's in charge. And when you recognize that, when you know it as intensely as you know anything else in this world, then he can use you in amazing ways, in ways that help others to encounter him. Now, there's an eerie echo of this text a few centuries later when God in the flesh walked among us. Luke chapter 5, once while Jesus was standing beside the lake of Gennesaret and the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, he saw two boats there at the shore of the lake. The fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. We got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to put out a little way from the shore. And then he sat down and taught the crowds from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, put out into the deep water. And let down your nets for a catch. Simon answered, Master, we have worked all night long, but have caught nothing. Yet, if you say so, I'll let down the nets. When they had done this, they caught so many fish that their nets were beginning to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees saying, go away from me, Lord, for I'm a sinful man. For he and all who were with him were amazed at the catch of fish they had taken. And so also were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. Then Jesus said to Simon, do not be afraid. From now on, you will be catching people. When they brought their boats to shore, they left everything and followed him. I like the little moment where Jesus says, let's go fishing. And Peter, the experienced professional, says that's not how it works. But for whatever reason, he decides to humor Jesus, and they go on out into the deep water, and there's this miraculous, unexpected catch of fish. And Peter realizes that this guy is not bound by the rules. And that can only mean one thing. Peter illustrates this reality pretty well for us here. When you have encountered God, when you have encountered God, you see yourself clearly. You know that you are not worthy. You know in the end, though, that maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe that's why he follows, because he realizes not only that he's a sinful man, but he realizes that that's not what matters in this situation. What matters is that he has been called. He's been chosen by this awesome God, and that's all that counts. And you may be thinking, okay, these are great stories, and it's kind of, you know, fun there. Isaiah 6, Luke 5, you know, but that's all a long time ago. And of course, maybe we have not encountered God in any sort of dramatic way like that. And there could be a lot of reasons for that. Maybe God just doesn't function in that way with us. Perhaps that's the case. But I'm afraid there's actually a more likely reason. I wonder, and when I say we here, I'm including myself, I wonder if we have not encountered God, have not seen God more clearly, because we have been content to play around the edges of relationship with Him. We've played at religion, yes, we've played at religion, but pursuing God? That's just for a few oddballs here and there. Besides, if you pursue God, He might catch you. And that could get dangerous. That could change our lives. And so amazingly enough, we kind of have this approach avoidance thing to our relationship with God. We want it close enough to feel safe, but we don't want to be close enough to be changed. We effectively keep God at a distance. I'm afraid that a lot of Christ followers are content, or maybe the way to put it is we're okay with where we are in our relationship with God. We're okay with it. We're okay with it. You've seen the commercials going around. I love them, you know. How's Dr. So-and-so? He's okay. Just okay. Hey, guess who just got reinstated? Well, not officially, you know. Do you really want a doctor that's just okay? Hey, we got a saying around here at the brake shop. If the brakes don't stop it, something will. You know. Are you just want a babysitter for your kids who's just okay? Bedtime's 11 o'clock, 8. Well, you all are so strict, you know. And yet, amazingly enough, we're kind of okay with our relationship with God being okay. Just there. When we read the Word, we hide behind this notion that we're supposed to read the Word of God to sort of mine some facts, as if we're preparing for some sort of a Bible Bowl quiz. No, we don't read it to expect to hear the voice of God. I think that's to our detriment. It's like we don't even expect that we might hear God's voice in God's Word, and that somehow God would speak to us. Now, I'm not talking about the sort of sight and land thing. God, what do you want me to do today? Where do you want me to go? Do not boil a kid in its mother's milk. Okay, I can do that. You know, no. I'm talking about people who stay in the Word and are staying in the Word for the purpose of hearing God's voice. Hearing what God has to say to us, because that's why the Word's here. I remember a couple of times in my life where just, you know, for some reason there was some transformative moment, some moment where I really felt like God was speaking to me. One time was in a class in school, and we were working on John chapter 1 verses 1 through 18, and I don't know where it came from. I've read that text so many times before. I've read that text a lot since, but I remember that day listening to that text. You know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and talking about the role of the Word in creating the universe. And then verse 14, the Word became flesh and lived with us. And then verse 18 about the Jesus making the Father known, and for whatever reasons that day, and I can tell you where I was. I can still see the scene in my mind. No, there wasn't smoke. No, the pivots of the temple weren't rattling. But the thought came to me, if this is true, then I can do nothing more than to live for God. If this is true, then Jesus needs to be the focus of my life. I don't know. Text an elder if you want, but I think that was God encountering me through his word and grabbing hold of me in a way. When we read the word, we hide behind this notion that we're just there to mine some facts from the page. Do we read the word expecting to hear the voice of God? When we come to our worship times, we can do a lot of things. We can show up to enjoy the show, or we can show up to not enjoy the show and let people know about it. Or we can show up to tick a box, get that done for this week. Whew, and it didn't go too far overtime today. That's great. Sometimes it does not even occur to us when we walk into this place to worship with other Christians that God might be speaking to us in this moment. That through the songs and through the reading of the word and through the participating in the Lord's Supper together, that God might be trying to get a hold of our hearts. And that when we gather together here, God is present with us. And that God is present with us as a transforming presence, if we will let him. Again, at the risk, because this is not about me, it's about God, but I can tell you where I was about 3 feet to the right of Joey there one Sunday morning when it had not been a particularly good week, and ministers define weeks as good or bad in different ways. I had a friend who said, this was a really good week. I only thought about quitting 3 times, you know. I'm sitting, you know, over there, and it had not been a particularly good week. And we sang the song, Blessed Be Your Name. And I'll never forgive Joey for that. And we get to the part where it's, you give and take away, you give and take away, my heart will choose to say, Blessed be your name. And I was so upset that that was the song before the lesson, because I was devastated and I'm not sure I had enough left to preach that morning, because God came and grabbed me in that line as we sang it together. Or rather, as you sang it, because I couldn't. And God said to me very clearly through those words that day, you have to make a choice, Greg. You have to make a choice. But so often we show up, and even us preacher types do, we just show up and we're just here to get her done. Do we even show up expecting that we might encounter God? Do we even think God is available to be encountered? I guess what I'm really getting at is this. Do we really want to say to God, I'm okay with where I am in relationship to you. Yeah, I'm okay. Do I even want to try to stand in front of God and try to form the words, I'm okay? Do we even want to encounter God? Are we afraid of what might happen? About 20, 25 years ago, some research was done among evangelical teenagers and college students. And it was really interesting, because the idea was, okay, what would you say? Let's imagine the scenario in which God comes in and God sits down beside you. What would God say to you? If God could just imagine for a second, God comes down and sits next to you, what would God say to you? And you know what the number one answer was? The number one answer among churched teenagers and college-age students, the number one answer was, if God sat down, there wouldn't be any eye contact, there wouldn't be anything, he would just sort of sit sit there and go, I am so disappointed in you. I am so disappointed in you. Well, now I could go full-blown Freudian on us there and say that's probably reflecting. You know, that's probably kind of, I'm not feeling real good about me, and so I'm pretty sure God's not feeling really good about me. But I think that's just so interesting, given the two texts we've looked at this morning. Isaiah, in the presence of God, realizes, I am unclean. I am unclean. And then all of a sudden, boom, nope, you're clean. I made you that way, and I got a job for you. And Simon Peter, I'm sinful. I'm a sinful man. And Jesus is like, please try to surprise me. Yes, I know. Got that point. Understand. Got a job for you. Are you willing to follow me? I'm struck by two similarities in these two stories we've looked at this morning. When Isaiah and Peter knew that they were in the presence of God, all their pretenses were blown away. They recognized fully in HD that their lives were messed up and they could only express their separation from God. That's one thing that's there in both of these texts. But the second thing is there that God's response was acceptance and a commission. I know that. Oh, God, I just know what you're going to tell me next is you're so disappointed in me. No, what I'm going to tell you next is you're clean, Isaiah. What I'm going to tell you is that's I got that, Peter. I understand. You're a fisherman on the Sea of Galilee. Follow me. Follow me. I have to believe that the same will be true for us. If we come to see God more clearly in our lives, whether that occurs suddenly or slowly over time, if we come to see God more clearly in our lives, if we learn to hear His voice, if we recognize that He is in charge, then we're going to feel pretty small. We're going to feel pretty broken. We're going to feel like, yeah, we don't measure up. And we're probably going to project on God that whole disappointment thing. But the next move is this, and the next move is God's. And that move is that whether in that moment or again over time, God will remind us to focus on Him, not ourselves. And to focus on how He sees us and not how we see ourselves. Because He doesn't use folks who are busy having it all together. He encounters and values and uses people like Isaiah, people of unclean lips. He encounters and values and uses people like Peter, people who are sinful. He encounters and values and works with people like us.